from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the 2011-2012 season in three first-class venues.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll talk with singer Heather Ramsey about her new Christmas album.
I'll find out about a unique auction of prehistoric artifacts that's happening right here in Indianapolis.
And I'll get a preview of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir's Festival of Carols. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Heather Ramsey grew up singing Christmas music, and for years her friends and family have been urging her to record a holiday album. She's finally done it and dropped into our studio to tell Sharon why making Peace Like a River was so rewarding.
So you're no stranger to our listeners, but I want you to remind us how you got started in music. Actually, it sounds as though you didn't really have much of a choice.
No, it chose me. It's followed me sort of my whole life. But I mean, when I was a kid, I always wanted to sing. I didn't grow up in an area where that was, other than at church or maybe in the school plays, that was something you could really do anywhere.
Smaller community.
Very small
town.
Community, but music was just a part of my family life, and I was always compared to my grandmother, who I never met. She passed away when my dad was very young, but they would say, "You sound just like Ruth," so they'd ask me to sing at all the different churches in the area, and so I've been singing since I was old enough to make noise, and at all the family functions and gatherings, there was always music.
Holy Father, you have come and chosen me now to carry your son.
Do you have siblings?
I do.
And do they sing or play? Or?
My brother, we try to convince him that he can sing. He did actually sing at my second wedding, surprisingly, and that
Wonderful.
Was the one time I got to hear him. But he doesn't like to do it very often in public. My sister's actually on the album. She is singing background vocals on Breath of Heaven with my mom. So she does sing, not professionally, but she likes to sing more in the group setting. But she's got a lovely, lovely voice, more soprano than I am. Yeah, it's definitely part of our sibling interaction.
You know, one great thing that church singing teaches you is harmony, because there are all the, you know, every hymn, it seems, has at least four-part harmony and sometimes more. But you were also attracted to instruments. You play flute and piano as well.
Mm-hmm.
Have you always kind of, for want of a better term, cross-trained, spent a little bit of time with all of those areas, and how did singing win out as your primary instrument?
Well, I was playing the piano when I was five because my mom insisted, and we would take lessons with Emma Jean Reffitt in her little house in Fulton, Indiana, and I think it was $5 for a half-hour lesson or something, and so that was just part of it. Was sort of expected. My brother was very bitter about it for most of our lives. He appreciates it now, but so piano was just sort of always part of my upbringing, and then it was sort of assumed then that you would be in band because I was in such a small school. You know, you had to be in band and cheerleading and football and cross country, and like you had to do everything because there weren't enough students otherwise. So, but flute was just sort of, you know, I fell into it and loved playing and you know, I've not picked it up as much, but I do use my piano quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Voice won out. Simply because it's where I'm most passionate. I love to play the piano, but I wouldn't say that it's my best instrument by far, and I've never spent hours and hours and hours and hours perfecting it. And with my voice, I've really felt like that was the way I communicate best. So the piano sort of just accompanies that, but it wasn't my primary focus.
You don't lose track of time playing the piano, but you do when you're singing, maybe?
Yes, that would be a great way to put it.
Help me be strong. Help me
who know you know about the ISIS projects, know about your jazz, the jazz part of you, but you move kind of freely between and among pop and R&B. Do you have a first love, or is it hard to choose?
I would say, and I've tried to define this for myself and found it difficult, because I love, like on my radio, I listen a lot to soul music and R&B and Motown. And I've like moved from jazz into listening to that on a regular basis and kind of flow back and forth. And I think what I like about both styles is the freedom to improvise and interpret. And so I don't like to pigeonhole myself necessarily as a style, but I do like to put a spin on something and add a new voice where I think it is warranted.
Uh-huh.
So if it's Karen Carpenter, I'm not going to go too crazy because I just love the way she did things.
Right.
But if it's a song that's been done several times, like When I Fall in Love or At Last, I like to I like the freedom to add my twist. And so that's why I love jazz for that reason. But I love the feel and the guts of Motown and soul and those styles from a content perspective.
So take us behind the scenes of the technical aspects of that. I often wonder about this. There are some songs, especially in the Great American Songbook, that, you know, certain artists own. It's like, oh, how I actually had this conversation with Michael Feinstein. How do you tackle something that as soon as the first piano intro notes come on, everybody's expecting Frank Sinatra's interpretation? You know, what do you kind of, if there are all these voices in your head, let's say you're going to record When I Fall in Love, how do you shoo Linda Ronstadt's voice out? How do you shoo, you know, all of the great singers before her out?
I think it's just, for me, been through years of doing it. So maybe when I first started doing The Nearness of You, for instance, I knew Nora Jones' version first.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't listened to a lot of older jazz in my growing up. I listened to classic rock and like Chicago and the Beatles and the Eagles and that kind of stuff, because that was what my dad was into, and Karen Carpenter. And as I got more exposed to jazz, I listened to a lot of Ella Fitzgerald, and you know, but I started out with Nora Jones's version of that song.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I listened to Ella Fitzgerald's, I probably would say that when I sang that song out, it had little elements of what I heard from her.
Mm-hmm.
And some Nora Jones. And then I might have heard somebody else's version and somebody else's version. And as I sort of melded all those together, I found my own voice with that song. So I think it's over time, as much as anything, that I've developed my own way of expressing it, but it's certainly informed by the people that I've heard.
So it's kind of like a stew a chemical reaction is another way to think of it.
Yeah,
where all these bits and pieces
come
together.
My vocal casserole.
There you go. I love it.
Little cheese on top.
Cassoulet, the album.
Yes, yes.
I can hear it now.
Thanks. That's my next idea. I'm going to put that down and give you credit.
It's coming on Christmas. They're cutting down trees. They're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on.
Hey, how do you know you're ready to record something? How do you know that it's time to commit something?
I think that it keeps coming out of the ether at me. So in the case of the Holiday album, first of all, my mom had been pushing for a Holiday album since the first one came out. And my dad a little bit, too. Because,
never underestimate the power of parents.
Yeah, they still have a big nudge that, you know, if you're going to do this music thing and we're going to take it seriously, do some Christmas music for mom, please. And a friend of mine had done some original work, and we had talked a couple times, and I was just feeling like there's a lot of sort of nudge for me to do something with this, I guess, genre, you would call it, since holiday music is its own animal. But and plus, I just love Christmas music, and I just felt like it was the next thing I wanted to share with the world from a recorded perspective. So so the pieces seemed to fall into place, and Monica sort of fell into place, and we were just ready to rock and roll on it. So
How involved are you in, do you do any of your own arranging? Do you work with you have kind of a little merry band that works with you often? How does that process work?
I've gotten more into arranging a lot for my students, actually, where they say the painter's house is never painted, but if it's for somebody else, you're more motivated to explore that. And And I'm interested in arranging, but had never done much of it or been exposed to it. And for my students, when they say, I really want to do this, I don't know, Katy Perry song, mm-hmm. and I'm looking at it and going, ooh. Maybe we can work with this a little. I get into arranging simply because I want to help them make it more interesting, and have started to understand the process for myself through them. So,
There's a very it's a Christmas album, but it's not Christmas carols per se.
Right.
It's songs. There's a very mellow mood to it. Some of the pieces are spiritual. Some are secular. Tell me, one of the tracks that particularly struck me, and you already mentioned the aspect of it being a family affair, Breath of Heaven. How did you remember first hearing that and thinking, oh my gosh, that needs to be mine?
it was a song, and Monica even raised her eyebrow a little bit, like, this doesn't go with the others. And I said, this is a song that if I'm going to create an album that's based around what represents sort of my roots in holiday music, mm-hmm. which was always such a big core for our family, this song was part of that from the time it came out. There was, like, back when we used cassette tapes and they actually had a track on cassette tape that we had to special order. My mom went right out and got that track and said, you're singing this at church this Sunday. And because of course I knew all the words, and we sang harmony in the car and back and forth, so I knew it. And I, ever since then, I sang it every year in the local area for different churches. And it was sort of one of those things. My mom said, I'd like that one. And my dad said, it needs to have that one on it. That's my dad's favorite Christmas song. And every year to this day at Christmas, my sister and I sit, I go to the piano, she stands with me, and we sing it in two-part harmony. And so it's just really got a lot of sentimental value.
Sure.
And so I felt like it was important, if I was going to do something from a holiday perspective, to have that as part of it.
Is there anything that didn't make it on this album that suggests there might be a part two coming in a year or two?
No, actually, surprisingly, much to my surprise, I liked everything we did. Normally there's that one or two where you're like, this could use a little more love, and I'm not sure, but we really felt like everything belonged there. And
what's your favorite track?
That's hard to pick. I would say that it kind of bounces back and forth, but I'm going to say Home for Christmas actually is my favorite. I love what Mark Buscelli did with the flugelhorn on it. And there's something about it to me that it's just, Monica calls them derangements. It's just modified enough that it when I hear it, I kind of perk up like, oh, this isn't what I expect.
Yeah.
And so I really enjoy the way that she put her spin to that song.
Sharon Gamble with Heather Ramsey. You can get her new Christmas album on Amazon.com or CD Baby, or you can attend one of her upcoming CD launch parties, even better, like the one this Sunday from 1 to 4 at the Rathskeller at the Athenaeum, where she performs with Monica Herzig. There's a brunch, adult beverages available, and rumor has it that St. Nick's going to drop in. You can give a call at 426-8543 for reservations. Again, 426-8543.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The local auction house known as Dan Ripley's Antique Helper Auctions is about to auction off a part of one of the largest and most important collections of prehistoric Native American artifacts. Travis DiNicola spoke with Dan Ripley and Christopher West about their upcoming auction of bird stones, banner stones, and arrowheads from the collection of the late Earl Townsend, Jr.
Tell me a bit more about Dan Ripley's Antique Helper. I know you've been in town for quite a while, doing some great auctions. I see a lot of stuff online, but a lot of people may not even be aware we've got such a great auction house here in Indianapolis.
Thanks. Our company's now 10 years old, and we're a full-service art, antiques, and collectible item auction house.
Okay. And so this is the type of thing, like with the Townsend collection, they actually came to you and said, we want you to take this, right?
They did. They actually hired an agent themselves, and mm-hmm. the agent brought them as a group to us.
Tell me a bit about, if you two would, about Mr. Townsend, the late Earl Townsend, Jr., who I know was an attorney and had a great collection of different Native American artifacts, and of course the ones that you're going to be carrying in your auction. Tell me a bit about his own collecting and his interests.
Well, he's a fascinating person, Travis. If you go back and kind of look at his history, he was roommates with Gerald Ford at Michigan Law School. He was an Indiana basketball all-star. He was the first broadcaster of the Indy 500 when it was televised for the first time.
I was looking at some of these like highlights of his life. I'm like, this guy was pretty amazing.
Yeah, he's fascinating. And yeah. Obviously, you know me more as a 20th century type person, but he fell in love with these birdstones and these rocks and these mm-hmm. ancient artifacts and really amassed this really amazing collection.
So the question that I have here, and I have to say I had never heard of Native American birdstones before, Chris, when you first told me about being able to acquire this collection and doing this auction. And then I started looking at the pictures of them and reading a little bit more about them, and they're absolutely beautiful. I mean, they're gorgeous. But if you would, give me sort of the quick summary as far as what these items are, because I think a lot of people may not be aware of these prehistoric stone sculptures.
Well, I think a lot of it is still a mystery. They're not entirely sure what their function was. And until probably about 100 or so years ago, they were kind of misidentified and thought to be a lot newer than they actually are because of their intricacy and how much they've been carved and the time that it took to go in it. But they found some, you know, most of them are found in fields when farmers are tilling their land. But they've also found some at burial sites. They wonder if it's a counterbalance on a spear or a ceremonial statue of some sort, mm-hmm. But there's still a lot of questions, I think, as to their actual function.
Now, I know that with the exhibit, with the auction, there's also a lot of arrowheads and things like that. Are they often found with arrowheads, do you know, or is there a direct connection at all that we know, or we're just guessing at this point?
I think we're just guessing. I mean, they're often found, like, in the same fields.
Yeah.
And some of the burial sites will have a higher concentration of some of the artifacts than, you know, just the random ones that have been lost throughout time.
But what about a specific geography? I mean, is there a way to sort of tie it to different parts of the country? I mean, I know it's difficult to tie it to any specific tribes that we know of, but what do you guys know about that?
Yeah, most of the material was found in the Midwest. It's related to the glacial came period, which extended from southern Canada down to south as Indiana, basically. Mm-hmm. And these were migratory people. So you do find different geographic materials, pieces made from different materials spread around, okay. which illustrates that they were migratory. But a lot of the pieces can be identified by the material that they're carved from, whether it's granite or slate or flint. And then the other features that identify where they might have come from would be the different styles or forms, which also help to date the time when the pieces were created.
Some of the pieces look like small animals, and it's, you know, looking online, I'm trying to get a sense of the scale, but they're not very big pieces for the most part, right? I mean, kind of like maybe the size of a thumb or a little bit bigger than that. Is that fair? Or
they're a little bigger,
bigger than that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But they are definitely small, and that leads, you know, to the theories of their use being the functional theories being that they were part of a spear thrower possibly some sort of a pendant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What really strikes me is whether they're, you know, identifiable as some sort of animal-type creature or, you know, some of them just in these kind of beautiful abstract shapes. They're very subtle. I mean, they're just kind of sublime. I mean, when you look at them, they're, you know, they're just kind of like they're smooth and elegant. And like I said, I've just seen the photographs, but you just want to touch them kind of. You're nodding, Dan.
I am. Actually, I thought you were going to ask me why they're called birdstones.
Why are they called birdstones?
Sometimes they look like frogs, and sometimes they look like mice, I don't know the answer to that, and that's my question, too.
Because, I mean, a couple I could see maybe are kind of bird-like, but
yeah,
certainly
definitely.
Not all. Also, then there's the term banner stone, and is that a different type of stone?
It is.
Okay.
A banner stone is the unique characteristic is that it has a central drilled hole mm-hmm. that allows it to slide on a shaft. And again, it could be part of a spear thrower called an atlatl. But the banner stone would have slid up and down the shaft that threw the spear, and the bird stone would have been affixed at the end and actually been some sort of a crux for that held the end of the spear.
Wow, okay. So now these pieces, from what I understand, this is kind of one of the best collections ever that has been put together of birdstones and banner stones and other prehistoric Native American artifacts. How did Mr. Townsend amass this collection? What do we know about, I mean, how he found them?
Well, we believe it was a lifelong passion for him, and it started from growing up on just here on the east side of Indianapolis. They actually found artifacts on the family property. If I remember right, I think they grew up somewhere around 20th and Post Road. So I think that's where his interest began. We don't know exactly.
Do you know
what
if
point.
He found a lot himself, like doing digs, or was he more of a collector?
No, he was a collector. He would buy the pieces.
Okay.
And what I've learned is that I've met people that have surface hunted for 40, 50 years of their life, and know friends and family that could state, between us, we have 200 years of surface collecting, and we've never found a birdstone, a banner stone, things like that.
Okay.
So there's absolutely no conceivable way that someone could amass a collection like Earl did without purchasing them.
And this is what you guys are having on this upcoming auction that takes place on Saturday, December 3rd, is actually it's just the first of what will be a series of auctions. I believe it's only, about a quarter of his entire collection?
That's correct.
And there's, more than, in this part alone, something like 50 birdstones?
That's correct.
Wow. Wow. So,
yeah.
I mean, this is, certainly museum quality.
Absolutely.
Know that, the prices range from, I know some of the estimates, in the low hundreds to, in the mid five figures or possibly more based on this. I mean, these are very desirable pieces.
Absolutely.
So for a collection like this, how important is it to be able to have this here in Indianapolis? Certainly you're I would imagine for your audience, for the interest in it, you're reaching out well beyond our borders.
Yeah, absolutely. We've already registered bidders from Paris, Australia, several West Coast collectors. And probably the biggest significance for the collection or the family themselves is that Earl was a strong proponent of the city of Indianapolis. He's buried on the highest point in Crown Hill Cemetery. And I heard that Earl would have rolled over in his grave if they'd had tried to take it in the collection somewhere else to sell it.
So it was really important to him and to the family to have it here.
It was, and we're proud to be in the position to be the auction house chosen.
So what I would like to know is, for someone who's listening to The Art of the Matter right now and thinking, okay, I want to go online and check out Dan Ripley's Antique Helper and see some photographs of these birdstones and the banner stones, what's the process for being able to come to the auction and look at the pieces, whether you think you may be, someone who's serious about buying or not, but just being able to, is there a chance to see the stuff live, or how does that all work? Christopher?
Well, we're going to give ample opportunity for collectors and, the local public to come see the collection. We're going to be doing a two-week preview. We are asking that people make appointments because demand is really high. But for the 2 weeks leading up to the auction, we'll be having a preview, and the pieces will be able to be seen that way. Currently, our full catalog is online with multiple pictures of everything, and the printed catalog we will have next week. So in addition to that, we will be having an opening reception party on that Friday before, which might be a good time to come look at the work and meet and see some of the collectors and get excited about this.
Very cool. Now, I know you've been learning a lot about this. We were chatting just a few weeks ago when you first started, doing your research and finding out about this. What are some of the interesting things you found out during the process of working on this, Christopher? Because this is certainly a different type of artwork than what a lot of Indianapolis audiences know you for. You've certainly with Christopher West Presents, really specialized in contemporary art. This is going about as far back as you can.
Pretty much, but it's amazing. And I, too, have been learning about these birdstones, which I knew nothing about until this came about. But it's amazing how contemporary they are. They are thousands and thousands of years old, and, they might even just be decorative in some cases. And they're gorgeous, and they've taken hundreds of hours to make, and fascinating, I think, on so many levels. But they do definitely have this abstracted, really almost 20th century feel to them. And so it's pretty amazing that this was happening thousands of years ago.
Some of them really do. A couple that stand out for me, I know there's a number of them that have the name Popeye on them. What is that from? Are we talking we're not talking Popeye the Sailor Man here?
I think, Dan, that refers to the eyes.
Yeah, yes. The ones that have the protruding eyes.
They really are Popeyes.
Are called Popeyes.
Okay.
That's right.
Because there's definitely a couple cool ones like that, but a few that really stood out for me. There's one that you've featured called the glacial, I believe, is it Kame type red slate birdstone. Just a sort of a really beautiful design.
Yeah, and Travis, I encourage you to come, you know, to the preview or come see the collection before it goes up for sale, mm-hmm. because just the difference in the materials and the colors, from the grays to the reds, they're just gorgeous.
Yeah, very lyrical. I mean,
yes.
The lines are just, I mean, just kind of amazing to look at. Yeah, I mean, this is quite an exciting thing for you guys. So now this, as I mentioned, is the first of what will be a series of auctions. What can you tell us about what's going to happen in the future, or how does this all sort of play out for you guys? Dan?
We have no scheduled plans for when the next auction will.
Okay.
Take place. So we'll get through this first one, and then we'll let you know.
Is this, I mean, you've certainly been in the business a while. You mentioned that Dan Ripley's Antique Helper has been around for over 10 years now. But is this one of the biggest single sort of collections you've had the privilege to be able to auction off?
Yeah, Travis, this is what I built this company for. We have a saying, what we say at Antique Helper is that we sell collections to collectors. This, to me, is the ultimate collection, and that's why I've announced that this sale would be the first in what we're calling the Dan Ripley Select Auction Series. Sales and collections that I feel meet or surpass my personal standards for collecting, and I've been in the business 20 years and three generations of Indianapolis dealers and collectors in my family, and I've seen a lot, and this is truly the ultimate collection.
Excellent. Sounds like, you know, both of you might have your eye on a piece or two yourself for your personal collections. That's got to be a temptation when you're looking at these beautiful works.
I think I speak for Christopher when I say both of us tend to gravitate towards the very best pieces in a sale, and they probably, those pieces are probably out of my range.
They're going to be out of my range,
too. Can't speak
too,
for you on that.
Well, this is a very exciting thing and a great opportunity for Indianapolis audiences to come check out a very unique style and form of art and just a great piece of history. And I wish you guys the best of luck with the sale, and looking forward to hearing about more of these select auctions that you're putting together.
Great. Thanks, Travis.
Thanks so much, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with auctioneers Dan Ripley and Christopher West of Dan Ripley's Antique Helper Auctions. Earl Townsend Jr.'s collection of prehistoric Native American artifacts takes place on December 3rd. More information, including an online catalog and information about the preview, is available online at antiquehelper.com, again, antiquehelper.com, or you can call 251-5635, again, 251-5635. Travis,
sure.
Is that a turkey that got away?
An escaped turkey.
Oh, no. Well, maybe we'll put it in the car and take it on the road to experience some arts events on our calendar, which is turkey-free.
That's right. That we call.
Our calendar that we call
What'll
We Do?
Things that we're thankful to be able to go see and
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely. I love that segue. What do you have?
Well, you know what? Next weekend on Art of the Matter, I've got an interview with the new director of the Christian Theological Seminary, Dr. Bolton, but I want to give you a heads up that they have a really cool event coming up next weekend as well. It's called Lessons and Carols, a community festival of Christmas, and it's presented by the Christian Theological Seminary as well as Christ Church Cathedral, and it is going to be taking place on Friday, December 2nd at the CTS at 7 p.m., and there's a festival and lessons and carols and all sorts of great things bringing together these two great organizations and a great way to celebrate the holidays. So again, next Friday, December 2nd, at 7 p.m. at CTS.
Fantastic. Hey, a legendary musician and storyteller is coming to town under the auspices of Storytelling Arts of Indiana. It's Patrick Ball, who's been performing for decades now on the Celtic harp. He's also a storyteller, and he'll tell traditional tales from A Child's Christmas in Wales, chapters from The Wind in the Willows, passages from Shakespeare, Yeats, Thomas Hardy, and many, many more. commingled with beloved pieces of seasonal music on the Celtic harp. This is a very family-friendly event, and again, if you've never heard Patrick Ball, you owe it to yourself to take advantage and go hear him in person. That's coming up next Saturday. That's December 3rd from 7:30 to 9:30 at the Basile Theater at the Indiana History Center, and you can find out more. You can tell your own stories and find out more at storytellingarts.org.
Very good. Hey, next weekend, of course, is First Friday in December, and there's a lot of gallery openings. One that I am looking forward to, is the Fragments Show, Drawings by Joseph Krohn at Wuglacoo's Studio and Garage over in the Circle City Industrial Complex off of sort of 10th Street and Mass Ave over there. This is going to be really cool. It's in the best tradition of film noir, which, Sharon, you know that I love. Krohn's moody shadows and light depict a world right out of Dashiell Hammett or Mickey Spillane. So that should be very fun stuff on a cold winter's night to check out with that air of mystery. So it should be a really interesting show.
You're going to wear your fedora, and Elizabeth's going to wear her stilettos.
Oh, I can't wait to see that.
I can see that.
So that's over at Wuglacoo's Studio and Garage. Next Friday night is the opening of the Joseph Krohn Show.
Speaking of First Friday, don't forget to keep your holiday shopping list front of mind as you stroll the galleries, because local art and local goods make terrific holiday gifts. You might as well support our local arts community while you're out there. Speaking of local community, Actors Theater of Indiana is bringing back its heartwarming tradition, A Year with Frog and Toad, the Broadway musical, as its holiday show. It's coming up on December 16th, 17th, and 18th. It will be this year at the Pike Performing Arts Center, even though they're now based at the Studio Theater at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. This particular series of performances will be at Pike Performing Arts Center. A Year with Frog and Toad, Actors Theater of Indiana, for more info on that.
Very cool. Hey, some other openings next week for First Friday on December 2nd over at IMOCA. Past Ephraimson Contemporary Art Fellows are going to be showing their work as part of a show called Fast Forward, featuring people who've won the Ephraimson Fellowship in the past, including Emily Kinnerick, Rose Partington, Jamie Paulus, among others. That should be a really cool show. And then over at the Harrison Center, Sugar Plum is their show. Have you heard about this, Sharon?
Just enough to be dangerous. Tell me more.
It's their annual holiday color-themed show. Each year they focus on a different color, and so this year it is plum. So all the Harrison Center artists will be creating plum-themed works or plum-colored works. You'll have Craig McCormick, Adam Noel, William Denton Ray, Carla Knopp. Lots of other great artists will be there as well. That should be a lot of fun.
I'm plum delighted about it.
Oh,
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. Hey, you might want to put on your dancing shoes if you go on Thursday, December 8th to hear Tad Robinson, Soul, Blues, and Funk, part of the Anything Goes concert series at the Indiana History Center. And again, that's coming up on Thursday night, December 8th. Dance off some of those holiday party calories, I'm just saying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not looking at you.
No, what are you saying, Sharon?
I'm looking at her and him.
Hey, this weekend is the opening of A Christmas Carol at the IRT, and a great tradition that continues on. Some fun things to know that all but one actor has played a role in Christmas Carol in the past in this year's cast.
Who's the newbie?
Well, it says the one who has not been in A Christmas Carol was a fan favorite in the IRT's production of Around the World in 80 Days, and that's Minnie Tagandi, and so it's the first time that she'll be a part of it, but everyone else is returning, and two married couples get to share the stage. Jen and Rob Johansson will be there, as well as Cora Vanderbrock and Matthew Brumlow are both in the show as well, and the Tiny Tims this year are played by some young female actors.
Cool.
Yeah, very fun. So Christmas Carol at the IRT kicks off this weekend.
Now, that's very family friendly, and mm-hmm. I have something that you will not want to take your children to. You need to stash them with the sitter. It is the next installment. Theater on the Square always does something a little bit naughty to be nice during the holidays, and they're opening this weekend. Don Wenauer, Gay Apparel 2, Fall on Your Knees. And I'm not going to say anything else about that, except that you can find out more by going to Theater on the Square's website.
What a visual image I have right now.
Yeah.
I'm a sad little elf. Hey, if you remember, Derwin Smedley 20th Century is a very cool shop on Mass Ave. Closed down a few years back, but great sort of interesting antiques and collectibles and fun stuff. Well, Connie Ziegler, who ran Derwin Smedley, is doing a pop-up shop in Fountain Square next weekend, and it's going to be on Friday the 2nd from 5 to 10 as part of their First Friday, as well as from Saturday 10 to 5 on the 3rd, and she's going to be doing a pop-up shop down in Fountain Square. You got to go down there to check it out at basically at 647 Virginia Avenue. So it will be a very cool place. Not the old location of Derwin Smedley, but down in Fountain Square.
And while you're down there, check it out. There are at least two new eateries that have opened in the last month. There's a Mexican one and a Peruvian one. Mm. So you can fuel your shopping. All right, I'm going back to family friendly for a moment. Cardinal Stage's family holiday musical is... Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow. It's Annie.
Annie for the holidays.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, strictly speaking, a Christmas show, but sure, why not? Why not? That runs December 16th through January 1st, so you can actually go after everything dies down a little bit.
I've just got a couple more things here. The Indiana Historical Society's 2011 Holiday Author Fair is coming up on Saturday, December 3rd from noon until 4, and it's going to feature about 50 or so, if not more, local authors who will have their books available for sale, and you can get them signed as well. Great holiday gifts at the Indiana History Center.
Love it. Something that you might want to take middle school or older kids to is Handel's Messiah. It is the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's production with combined church choirs of Tabernacle and Fairview Presbyterian Churches this year, and it will take place at Tabernacle Presbyterian Church on Saturday, December 10th at 7:30 and Sunday, December 11th at 3 o'clock. Great acoustics at Tab where they were last year. Handel's Messiah.
There you go. And last thing I've got is Jericho at the Phoenix Theater is still playing through this weekend, and now you can also start planning to go see A Very Phoenix Xmas Our Goose Is Cooked, which will just be a lot of fun. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about that in the coming weeks, but always, well, it's always fun, if not somewhat irreverent.
And
there'll
be
lots of... Is that a goose? A thankful a Christmas goose? You do a good turkey, Sharon. But
my last thing is this is a natural time of year to find out what you can do in Santa Claus, Indiana. And there's a new website, which is interactive. It's at santaclausind.org, santaclausind.org, and you can also just chart out all sorts of things to do with your kids in Santa Claus, Indiana.
Very good. And we'll be back next week with more things we're thankful for on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Over the past decade, Dr. Eric Stark has led the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir to great acclaim. Sharon Gamble invited Eric in to learn how he keeps the choir's beloved Festival of Carols fresh and inspired.
So I want to talk about Festival of Carols, but I also want to talk about the CD you just released. How did that come about? Was that always intended to be part of the 75th anniversary celebration?
We knew that we wanted to release a CD in the 75th anniversary season. And so the question was, what would it be? And
that's got to be a hard decision because, and you've been with the ISC.
I'm in my 10th year now.
I thought it was a decade.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you think about all the material you've prepared in that length of time.
80,000 concerts, I think, in the last 10
years. Did you
just
put them all up on a dartboard and just start throwing darts?
We have, for a period of time now, engaged really top flight recording assistants, engineers, when we do a live performance of major works, just in the event that, as Michael Petrie, our executive director, will say, we come off stage and we go, wow, that was the one, we'd like to put that in a can and sell it.
Sure.
And so a number of years ago, actually, 2007, we did a live performance of Mendelssohn's Elijah, the complete wonderful oratorio, mm-hmm. with a great cast of soloists, both local and from beyond Indianapolis, and eventually settled on that one. We asked our recording friends over at the Lodge Studios to give us the raw footage again, and we took a listen to it this summer to make sure we wanted to move forward. And then when we made the decision to do it, it was about a week in the studio, mixing and editing and, you know, kind of adjusting.
Performances had you done?
We had just done one, but we also recorded the dress rehearsal.
So we had
a little backup
if
we needed it, and perhaps over a drink sometime I could tell you, you know, if we used any of that extra footage. But it's a fantastic recording. It's the complete oratorio on two discs, made with our friends from the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra and the Indianapolis Children's Choir in Clues Memorial Hall. And we couldn't be more pleased with the way it really captures and encapsulates the identity of the symphonic choir. We do all kinds of performances. We do gospel, we do vocal jazz, we do Christmas stuff, but we are a symphonic choir, and our bread and butter is the major works for chorus and orchestra. And we haven't, until this release, had a recording out there of a major work, and so we're pleased now to have one in our 75th anniversary year.
And to borrow a phrase from another genre, Elijah is a good piece to show off the wall of sound that is a choir of your size.
Well, it's hard to beat Mendelssohn for choral writing and orchestration. It's just these choruses, one after the other, are dramatic and powerful and radiantly beautiful. Mm-hmm. And if I do say so myself, our singers handle them really, really well. And I think this CD comes as close as anything can come, I think, to capturing the experience of hearing the piece live and getting that energy and that joy and that drama that comes off the stage.
So obviously there's an artistic lens to look through to say what piece will show us off best, what did we really come away going, wow, we nailed that one. There is no way a performance could be better. But there has to be a business side too. Was there a little bit, and Michael's in the room, so I'm trying not to put him on the spot, but if you want to come up and join, feel free. But did you also look out there and say what recordings, you know, does the market have enough recordings of Elijah?
Right. That was part of the equation as well. We had considered for a time releasing our performances from last year of the Rachmaninoff Vespers. Wonderful piece, probably not as well known as the Mendelssohn, and after a little bit of digging, we discovered that a number of recent recordings had come out. Kansas City Chorale, which won a Grammy Award, and the Dale Warland Singers, you know, some really fine groups. Well, we can go up against that. I'm comfortable with that, but let's consider some other options as well.
Sure. Smart guys. Smart team you have there. And now, making a recording is one thing, getting it out there in the world is another. What mm-hmm. is the campaign to get this known?
We're telling everybody we can. We're using new media to help push the announcement and the rollout. We had a wonderful local event with about 100 of our close friends and supporters, where we actually had the public release of the CD. Mm-hmm. And we invited Tom Skurich, who was our Elijah for that performance, to come back. And he sang a little at the event, which was great, and generated a lot of excitement and sold a bunch of CDs that very night. The singers are helping us, the current singers in the choir helping us get the word out. And we're also placing the disc on iTunes and Amazon and those kinds of places as well. For us, you know, not being a mega corporation like the Atlanta Symphony or Cincinnati Pops, you know, we look for kind of the niches where there's an opportunity for us to move this thing forward. And we feel good that we're finding them. It'll probably be somewhat like our last CD, which was a Christmas CD, that it wasn't like 4 weeks on the bestseller list and then nothing. It was just a steady, kind of a consistent, especially around Christmas time each year, that we were able to move those.
What year was that?
That came out in end of 2006.
Okay, yeah. I know you can't say specifics or it would undermine the definition of a flash mob, but might there be a flash mob in support of Elijah somewhere?
Well, that's a very good idea. We, as you know, we did a flash mob at the end of May in conjunction with the Indianapolis 500 race weekend out at the Indianapolis airport. It's available on YouTube, so if any of our listeners want to check it out, Indy Choir Flash Mob will get you to it. We did Carmina Burana with two grand pianos and a full battery of percussion right there in the Civic Plaza. And I think the sound is still echoing through the concourse. We have talked about what the next step might be in that effort. Maybe something around a certain event in February. We're not exactly sure just yet.
Okay. Well, that would be a super idea. Sorry. Could not help it. Yeah, air quotes. Yes, it's radio. So, but meanwhile, it's not as though you don't have a full plate with the Festival of Carols, which has become a time-honored tradition for many, many in our community. You've commissioned a couple of pieces. Let's talk about that.
Well, the Symphonic Choir is committed to helping bring new works to light, not just for us to sing, but for other choirs to sing as well. Mm-hmm. And so every year now, for almost the entire decade that I've been with the choir, we've released a new world premiere, something that we've commissioned. And we always send out about 150 copies to choir conductors at churches and schools around the area so that they're aware of what's going on and have the opportunity to perform some of these new musics with their own groups. And that has evolved now so that each year at Christmas time we have a competition. And we invite any emerging composers 35 years of age or younger to submit a new work that has not yet been publicly performed for our panel of one to select a winning contribution. And we perform that winning piece at the Festival of Carols each year. We're in our third year with this. The first year, we sang a wonderful piece, Carol Lullaby, by a composer from South Carolina named Molly Imes. And the piece was immediately picked up and published by Beck and Horst Press, which is one of the larger sacred choral presses here in the United States. Last year's piece was motet set in Latin by a young man who teaches Spanish and French at a parochial school in Michigan and who went on to win a Vatican-sponsored composition contest a few months after winning ours.
That's fantastic.
Daniel Nags is his name. This year, we're doing a wonderful piece by a composer from California. It's a beautiful G.K. Chesterton text with piano accompaniment, and the choir has really taken to it. It kind of dwells upon the contemplation of the humble side of Christmas, that is the child born, you know, in a place that had no room for him, and what the implications are for the Christian in considering kind of how that projects out for all of us. And then we also commissioned a young man whose name is Shane Mons. He's a graduate student in composition at Butler University to write a piece for us. I felt because of the anniversary year, we'd like to do two commissions this year. And so he's given us his own setting of What Child Is This for unaccompanied choir. It's ethereal, evocative. I've likened it to looking through the window at a manger scene with rain streaking down the glass, so it kind of comes in and out of focus. And at once you can recognize something, and then it kind of becomes a little blurry around the edges.
I'm hearing some counterpoint there.
A little bit. Some interesting kind of harmonic slips and slides, but it's quite beautiful. And so we're thrilled to bring both pieces to new light in just a few weeks.
And you're working with your Spotlight Choir. I know that you've been building your educational outreach program, and it's one of the most active in the country.
Yeah. Well, we've had a real commitment to helping bring music to schools and giving high-quality performing experiences to young performers whenever we can. And now this will be our 10th year to feature a high school on our Festival of Carols concert. This year we're featuring the chamber choir from Manuel High School on the South Side. Spencer Lloyd is their director, a very fine group that our listeners may know about from reading some of the columns in the Indianapolis Star.
Sure.
And they will sing a couple selections on their own, and then they'll join us to close the concert with a piece by John Rutter called New Year, a very lovely kind of ethereal piece. And we're going to finish the concert with the high school choir and our friends from the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra in a rendition of the Hallelujah Chorus.
Ooh.
So that'll be an exciting, uplifting way to finish the performance.
What's the hardest thing about setting the program for Festival of Carols each year?
Well, if you read my blog, you'll find out how I choose music for this concert. I just posted a week or so ago about my process for selecting the holiday music for the Festival of Carols. And it's a long process. It's arduous, but it's one that I enjoy a lot because I learn so much new. And I set as a goal for myself this year to try to do as much new music to the choir as possible. So in fact, we're just, except for the Hallelujah Chorus, which they can sing in their sleep, we're only repeating one other piece that was on our Christmas CD a few years ago. Huh. And I had a chance to travel to South America this summer to do some guest conducting. And I took some stacks of music and some stacks of CDs from a couple of publishing companies that I'd received. And whenever I wasn't teaching or conducting, I was in the hotel room listening to Christmas music.
From the neighbors?
Well, I had the volume down and my earphones on. But, of course, it's south of the equator, and it was July, so it was wintertime down there.
Right, right.
So it was actually kind of appropriate. And in Bolivia, where I was, there's really no heat in any buildings. So here I was bundled up with the comforter from the bed around me and my hat and my jacket on, listening to all this Christmas music. And I felt like those unique circumstances brought me to some really great choices. And the singers and I are enjoying working on the repertoire this year a lot.
Sharon Gamble with Dr. Eric Stark of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. You can hear their Festival of Carols Friday, December 2nd at 8 p.m. at St. John the Evangelist Church in downtown Indianapolis, and Saturday, December 3rd at 8 p.m. at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church in Carmel.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 when I talk with some dancers who will be performing in the Nutcracker at the Indianapolis School of Ballet.
I'll get a preview of some boogie-woogie holidays.
All right. And I'll meet Dr. Matthew Bolton, the new president of the Christian Theological Seminary. Plus, we'll also have our arts calendar we call What Do We Do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the 2011-2012 season in three first-class venues. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.